This is fun! The FU Network!
Hello and welcome to the No Bullpen on FU Politics on Fun the FU Network. I'm Stephen Kersner, and today we're going to focus on an endangered species. It's known as critical thinking. Now, I don't know if thinking is actually a species, but as a species, human beings seem to have abandoned critical thinking in favor of reacting emotionally and choosing teams. And it's played out very, very evidently in the United States over the past four years since the last election campaign and election. We saw during the election here in Canada, we saw an awful lot of critical thinking go by the wayside in favor of emotional thinking, if you can call emotion and thinking the same thing, if emotional thinking is a thing, I don't know. And then we saw it here in Canada this past week when a man many consider to be a Canadian national icon, Don Cherry, host of Coach's Corner on Hockey Night in Canada, which is almost for many a holy pilgrimage every Saturday night on television. He made a comment that was derisive of immigrants, and we'll get into the details of that shortly, and was fired a couple days later. We had a panelist on a talk show talking about Don Cherry being fired, and in it she mentioned that she had been bullied as a kid by jocks, by the hockey jocks of her community, and she went on to talk about how she doesn't worship at the altar of hockey, and she made some generalized comments about spending $5,000 to outfit your kid in hockey gear. Why don't these people go out and broaden their view of the world? Just generalizations of who hockey families are, which was wrong. But she also mentioned that the bullies that were the bane of her existence when she was younger were tended to be mostly white boys. Now, because she identified their skin color and she is perceived to be center left, and was not fired for her comments, people on the right were saying there's a double standard because Don Cherry made a comment and she made a comment and Don Cherry got fired and she didn't. Now let's first, before I introduce the panel, well actually no, I'm going to do this the other way. I'm going to introduce our panel because we have an international panel tonight, and I'm thrilled to have the people we have with us. We've got Andrew McLeod. He's an award-winning author and currently the Legislative Bureau Chief for the West Coast's premier political website, The Tyee. Thanks, Andrew, for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Well, we've got Erica Eiffel. She's the host of the Bad and Bitchy podcast and the author of a very insightful column in Maclean's magazine this week about Don Cherry's lasting effect on hockey in multicultural Canada. Thank you for joining us, Erica.
Thank you.
Kyla Lee is one of the leading DUI attorneys in British Columbia, definitely a rising star and very well known there, and definitely as a lawyer who spends a lot of time in court, definitely somebody who employs critical thinking. Hafiz Narani is a digital marketing consultant and analyst and the producer of Mensplaining podcast here on FU Politics, on which he's also a panelist. Thank you for joining us, Hafiz.
Thank you.
And special guest from Paris, France. Yes, not Paris, Ontario, which does exist. Paris, France. Helen Lee Buig, who's the founder of the Reboot Foundation. And tell us about the Reboot Foundation, Helen.
Sure. Thanks, Stephen. The Reboot Foundation is a nonprofit organization that was founded to fund researchers to elevate critical thinking.
Okay. So that's... this is clearly up your bailiwick. Now, and Kyla, I don't think I gave you the chance to say hello. Hello, Kyla.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay, so let's compare as a launching point on discussing the decline of critical thinking in public discourse. Let's look at the two statements made by the two Canadian media personalities and use that as a launching point. Don Cherry was talking about, now in Canada, Helen, you're a transplanted American in Paris, so you may not know that in Canada, our Remembrance Day tradition to remember our veterans that have fallen and the veterans who are currently serving is to wear a little basically paper / plastic felt poppy on your lapel that are sold outside stores. You put money in, you put the poppy on. The poppy typically disappears within 12 hours and you have to buy another one. But it is our way of showing respect for the soldiers and for the people who sacrificed for our way of life. And in his Coach's Corner rant, he was talking about how people, he saw less and less or fewer and fewer people wearing poppies in Canada. And then he focused on immigrants for some reason. He says, "You people love our way of life, love our milk and honey. At least you could pay a couple of bucks for poppies or something like that. These guys paid for your way of life that you enjoy in Canada." If he had just said, limited his comments to Canadians not wearing poppies, different story. Jessica Allen, in response, says, "I'm told he's a Canadian icon. He's a symbol of the great sport of hockey, which is the sport that unites us across this country. And that narrative is the one that strikes a nerve with me," she said, "because I don't worship at the altar of hockey. I never have. Maybe it's because of where I grew up and going to a couple of different universities." And she said, "In my mind, in my experience, who does? They all tended to be white boys who weren't very nice. They weren't very thoughtful. They were often bullies. Their parents were able to afford to spend $5,000 a year on minor hockey. You could do other things than spend time in an arena. You could go on a trip and learn about the world, see other things. The world is a big place. Maybe get outside that bubble." Now, these are clearly both statements which invoke implications of race, if not direct mention of skin color. But clearly they are different. Don Cherry, with his "you people love our way of life, you come over here," he was talking about immigrants. And he has no way, first of all, of knowing whether the people he saw who weren't wearing poppies were immigrants or citizens that are born here, who just happened to have a different ethnicity, different skin color. But that focus on immigrants and focusing the blame on the decline of this tradition on immigrants, it breaks broadcast standards rules, and it broke the code of conduct of his employer, and he got fired. Jessica Allen was talking not about generalities, but about her personal lived experience, and was talking about the boys that bullied her. And she said they all tended to be white boys, which is, for the purposes of what she was saying, irrelevant and irresponsible. But she was talking about a lived experience versus Don Cherry talking generalized about immigrants, "you people who come over here." Yet we've got an argument that because Don Cherry was fired by his employer, Jessica Allen should be fired because they are the same, when in fact they are not the same. And if you use any critical thinking, you can see that a generalization versus a narrative of your own lived experience, they're not the same thing. We had during the election here, just thank God it's over, but it was only a month ago, videos surfaced of Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, in blackface in a high school video in the 1990s singing Harry Belafonte's "Deo." And there was also a video of conservative leader Andrew Scheer from about 10 years ago comparing a dog leg to gay marriage. Now, Justin Trudeau, since that time in high school, grew up, became an adult, and became one of the leading voices for multiculturalism in Canada. When other countries were refusing to take Syrian refugees, Justin Trudeau said Canada will take more. He's done quite a bit in his life since high school to show that he definitely supports immigrants in Canada and welcomes them. And he also apologized and said there was no excuse for what he did. Andrew Scheer, the conservative leader, did not apologize, refused to apologize on several occasions, and has refused to attend any pride parades. And people say there was a double standard there because people were criticizing Scheer for his anti-gay remarks, but not continuing to criticize Justin Trudeau for his blackface, ignoring the fact that Justin Trudeau was in high school and apologized for it. And his life since then has pointed in another direction. Whereas Andrew Scheer, it was only a few years ago, and he has not repudiated those opinions and has continued to avoid anything to do with supporting the gay community in Canada. Those two things are clearly not the same if you use critical thinking. But people aren't using critical thinking. People are using emotions. And Helen, when you hear these stories, what pops into your head? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, so about the poppy, you know, since Brexit didn't quite happen yet, even though it's on process, as you know, in the UK, there is a similar practice of wearing the pin, either real or plastic. But listen, to answer your question, I think the fact of the matter is, I don't, you know, you started this conversation saying that critical thinking declined over the last 4 to 5 years. I think fundamentally what you're witnessing in your story is a bit of the phenomenon of the way media gets transmitted, how people gather their information that fundamentally has changed, where we have bigger issues of actually not being able to differentiate between an opinion, a fact, a bias, even in terms of the way we gather information. And let me explain a little bit more on that. Obviously, it is a natural known fact that the reason why there's a spreading of fake news even is because a lot of things get picked up. Things become much more precarious where people catch on more to information on topics that do touch on the nerve of emotion. Because facts can be boring, whereas emotion and things that touch on death, things that touch on racism, they're just much more explosive emotionally. And the fact of the matter is we live in a generation today where everything is based on instant gratification, including the way we gather information. The Reba Foundation did a survey on how people gather information today. Over 90% of people gather information online and not on paper. And so the spread of the information, the way we gather facts, it is much more difficult, especially when you gather information even from institutional media sources online, because you only get snippets and you don't actually have the time to pause and think about what is the context, who is the author, does this make sense, is this truly just an opinion or is this a fact? And that's where a lot more of the confusion happens. You know, I think as we really gather more and more information via online.
It's interesting you say that, Helen, because it may be a surprise to our panelists, but the more Canadians or the information source most Canadians get their news from is actually Facebook in Canada. It's not any of the major news networks. It's Facebook. So that underscores what you're saying. And if I understand correctly what you're saying, it's that it's the method by which we get our information that has had an effect on our critical thinking. Newspapers used to be, the news happened on Monday, you read about it on Tuesday, and there was columns and there was columnists and there was reporters that would give you context. Whereas now everything's busy, busy, busy. There's a lot of clickbait, trying to grab eyeballs, even in the traditional media websites. And so they go for the gut. They go for what's going to grab people emotionally, and often people don't go beyond that headline.
I would add that traditional media is part of the problem of clickbait,
okay,
and that they don't provide the context anymore. They don't provide that narrative quality. They don't provide anything but straight facts, and that's it. And I'm wondering if they know that they're writers. You know what I mean? And so I what I find is that, you know, things like Vox, you know, Vox, right?
Yes, the website.
The website. Things like Vox explainers do well for a reason. Things like podcasts do well for a reason. The reason is that you start to get into the milieu of the different threads of different issues. And what I find is that there are so many different threads of these issues that coincide, that link together. And I believe that one of the failures of Canadian media has been the inability to highlight those threads and to the inability to provide the context through which people can think critically.
Okay. Andrew, going to go to you as somebody who is a writer. Do you see any parody? Let me just back it up a bit. First, do you see any parody between what Don Cherry said and what Jessica Allen said?
No, I see them as quite different. I didn't actually see the Cherry comment live, but I did have the question of, you know, why is Don Cherry talking about the poppy anyway? I mean, his job, he's the coach's corner. He's supposed to be talking about hockey. It seems to me he's off topic to start with.
That's Don Cherry. You don't stop Don Cherry. Don Cherry talked about whatever he wanted to. Let me tell you.
Yeah, of course. You know. And so he was hired to do that. And then when he does it, he's fired. So, I can see it from both sides.
Wait a second.
Robert Jago tweeted something along the lines of when Jess Allen has spends 40 years giving bigoted comments, then maybe it's time to fire her. Okay. No, from both sides, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, like Don Cherry was hired to be controversial. He is, you know, he's got a long history of saying things that a lot of us, you know, tune out. I ignore him. I find him kind of a clown. So I can't really see how the network is surprised when he says something offensive.
Well, there's the line, and there's towing the line, and there's teasing the line, and then there's stepping over the line. And to say that there's any parody whatsoever, I think is false. When somebody's talking about their lived experience, if the people who bullied her were in fact white, it's an irrelevant fact based on what she was saying, but it is a fact. Whereas Don Cherry talking about "you people come over here," he's talking about, and he has no way of knowing if the people who weren't wearing poppies were immigrants or not. And you know what? Don Cherry also, he broke, I think, the rules of the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. I think he broke the code of conduct of his employer. And, you know, why did he get fired? Because, yeah, maybe for a long time, people have been desensitized about racist comments and their effect, but we're now becoming much more sensitized. And we've decided, you know what? Not okay anymore. Let's go over to Kyla, your thoughts.
You know, I don't actually view this comparison between the Allen comments and the Cherry comments as being a lack of critical thinking. I think it's actually it's evidence of good critical thinking happening in our society. On the one hand, you have somebody that said something that was inherently offensive, completely baseless. There's no, you know, there's no study that's shown that immigrants wear fewer poppies than people who are born in Canada. It was just pulled completely out of thin air with no support, and it was xenophobic. Whereas Ms. Allen's comments were based on her lived experience. They were identifying something which was directly related to privilege and power. There's a lot of privilege and power that comes with growing up as a white male in an upper middle class family that can afford to spend $5,000 a year on whatever type of recreational activity your child does. In this case, the example was hockey. And she's identifying a problem that came from a culture that generally, in her experience, was made up of people from this position of privilege and power, which is why her comments aren't problematic and why she's not being fired. And yes, there are all these people who are calling for her head. And there's always going to be, now that we have the internet and now that we have this, 24-hour news cycle and everybody has the ability to chime in on everything, there's always going to be some person out there who doesn't agree with what somebody says, who calls for their firing or who calls for their head or whatever the case may be. But the fact that it hasn't happened, that her bosses haven't caved to the pressure, that the Broadcast Standards Council hasn't said, yeah, she committed a violation. The fact that that hasn't happened actually shows that the people who are responsible for making the important decisions are still exercising and using critical thinking.
Well, I think I'm referring, when I talk about the decline of critical thinking and in discourse, more to what we see on social media, not the people who are her bosses or the bosses at Hockey Night in Canada, but the general discourse back and forth between what is identified as left and right. And that demonstrates a lack of critical thinking. If you follow Twitter threads, you'll pull your hair out. And then Don Cherry the next day said his answer to being fired was, "I know what I said and I meant it. Everybody in Canada should wear a poppy to honor our fallen soldiers." And so his defenders are saying, see, he meant everybody, and he said everybody in Canada. He didn't say that the night that he was fired.
He didn't mean everybody. Come on. That was just him backtracking. You know, I'm really sometimes am surprised at how seriously these people are take, not Don Cherry, but in terms of the critical thinking discourse. Okay. So we have to acknowledge that there are just some favorite hits that people, especially from the right side of the spectrum, like to use. Number one is whataboutism. So right after Cherry was, may have been right after he was fired, I saw Trudeau blackface trending. And it was trending because of the whataboutism of the people who supported Cherry. Okay. Oh, well, Cherry said this, but what about Trudeau? He got reelected, which has nothing to do with anything, to be honest. And that is a ploy. It's a play. And, you know, what I see from certain people are basically playground politics. It's childish politics. It's the, I know you are, but what am I? It's the, and we're taking those lines of argument seriously. And I think that's a problem.
Interesting point of view. What do you think, Helen?
I think going back to your point about Facebook, the challenges that we have, there's twofold that we're kind of missing in the equation about these comments and how it creates a feeding frenzy is, as you know, be it Google, be it Facebook, you know, all these social media forums are actually based on an algorithm that helps you basically, it shows you actually even statements or feeds that share more of your previous searches or previous views. And so it becomes a feeding frenzy in and of itself in terms of selective thinking. So I actually think of the opposite of critical thinking, not so much emotional thinking, but selective thinking. And clearly, the way the social media, the way they generate revenue itself is actually, it's actually gearing the consumer and the reader towards selective thinking. So that just, you know, is a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of the endless, feeding frenzy in terms of sort of extreme views. So that's why you're getting less and less central views, but more extreme views. The second thing I want to point out about this is not only on the selective thinking, but is don't forget about the bots, right? Because I think even including Facebook, the number, especially in the number of commentaries that are actually created, not even by individual comments, but are created by computers, what PR agencies often do, especially on political subjects, is to try to counterbalance the number of comments to try to be neutral. So there's this, if you want to go against sort of a general trend. So the combination of the natural algorithm combined with even we talk less about bots in order to create additional commentary around things is only creating a bigger magnitude of the problems that we're facing.
That's interesting. You point that out. Now, Helen, do you think that people are aware that they are making comparisons which are not actually apples to apples, and they're aware of it, but they're doing it for political purposes? Or do you think that they've just turned off their faculties and are just engaging in kind of a mob, a mob mentality and identity politics?
Well, the mob mentality is again, it's easier, right? It's like critical thinking's hard because you have to stop and think. You actually have to think about your own thinking. It's about metacognition, whereas emotional thinking and selective thinking is actually comfortable because you're actually just looking for more additional sources that defend your existing preconceived notions and your initial biases. So that's one dimension. I think the other challenge that we're having with the problems with the overall digital media is actually disengagement of the population, because if you do all sorts of surveys, at least in the US, 32% of the people that have been surveyed, actually only 30% of the people actually say that they trust what they read in media. So that again contributes even more to not really being able to distinguish what an opinion is and what a fact is and what's really truth out there, what's bullshit. So it becomes just this total amalgam. And that, again, only nurtures even further for people to just throw out random comments there and treat it like it's actually a fact thing.
Okay. Now, Hafiz, we haven't gone to you yet, and I feel terrible.
That's fine. I talk lots on every other show, so.
Okay. That's true. You have your quotient. But what are your thoughts? Do you think that the people online who have been battling it out between Jessica Allen and Don Cherry, as the most recent example, are deliberately using selective thinking? Or do you think that they honestly believe that there is some parity because both people's comments involved something to do with race or place of origin, or so they had some commonality, that because there's some thin tissue of commonality, they are in fact the same? Do you think they believe that to be the truth, or do you think that they are out there to try to make a political point, or is it selective thinking? They're believing what they want to believe because it's more comfortable, as Helen pointed out.
I think there's a couple of dynamics here. First off, even before the election, and from about 2015 onwards, we've seen a real polarization in communication on the social media platforms within Canada. It's no longer critical thinking, it's battle of groupthink. And it's not just the right that's guilty of it, people on the left are guilty of it, centrists are guilty of it. What it comes down to is one-upping the other side. It mainly began with owning libs, and this concept continues on today even in these topics. So when Don Cherry comes out and there's a reaction to that, the first step, as we've heard, is that whole whataboutism comes about, because it's carrying on a battle that was fought from the last time this came out. So these issues can't just stand on themselves anymore. They have to stand as an entire experience of what can be perceived as racism for minorities versus Canadian centrist culture. The issue comes where people forget what the actual experience is for people that experience racism in Canada. So from what you can see from the Trudeau blackface coming around at the same time as John Cherry, is that if you were willing to forgive Trudeau, but you're not willing to forgive Don Cherry, you have to, first off, you're a hypocrite. Secondly, you don't actually care about racism. These are the same things. But no one is stopping to ask how someone that is a person of color, or that, you know, has a lived experience being racialized, experiences these things. It's almost as though if you've had an opinion on any of those things, you have to instantly give your opinion on this as well. Now, as someone that is an immigrant that moved to Canada and learned about hockey from someone like Don Cherry through his Rock'em Sock'em series and his Hockey Night in Canada stints. I think as if I was to analyze the person that is Don Cherry, he is a controversial character. I mean, CBC even has a two-part miniseries on him, and you can see him as this battle-axe character that's always been there in Canadian politics. But as the story has grown, we see the other instances of Don Cherry's sort of insulting communication, I'd say, towards a variety of different ethnic groups, a variety of different people. And the question we all begin to ask is, the further back you look, the worse it is. And this is actually the least worst thing he said. So
I guess it's the straw that broke the camel's back. What do you think, Erica? Do you think that people are deliberately clouding the issue by saying if one person does something that has something to do with, for example, race, and another person says something that has something to do with race, that they exist on the same moral plane and the circumstances don't matter, they should both be treated the same way, the same kind of punishment? Or do you think they actually believe that, or do you think that they're doing it for political advantage?
I think it's both. I think the political advantage gives them an out for uncomfortable feelings. And I know thinking is not supposed to be based on feelings, but when we talk about race, there is it is based and basically centered around the feelings of white people who have the power in this country. And so I find it interesting that throughout this whole conversation, not just here, but elsewhere, we haven't talked about Indigenous kids when it comes to hockey. And there was an incident, Humboldt was a good example, and there was a writer who basically talked about the difference between the Humboldt kids and the GoFundMe that they were able to raise, and the Indigenous kids who I think had a similar incident happen, and what they were able to raise. And so I think what we have to understand, number one, is that Canada and Canadians have a really, really remedial understanding of race. They do not understand the power structures. They do not understand that racism is structural and how that plays into individual experiences. What Jessica, I forgot her last name.
Alan
was yes. talking about. She said something to the effect of, look, the people I knew who were shitty in hockey happened to be white. She didn't say white boys in hockey are like this. And those are two separate, distinct ideas.
Yes.
And the fact that that hasn't been parsed out, like I've been parsing it out on Twitter, but the fact that that hasn't been parsed out really tells me that there is a fundamental understanding of how to talk about statistics, number one, and proportion. And there is also a fundamental misunderstanding of how to talk about race.
Okay, I want to just jump in there, and I want to move us away from these specific cases and race, and just talk about the value of critical thinking, what it is, and its importance to a society. I'll go first to Kyla. You have to use critical thinking as a lawyer. I'm making an assumption here, but you are a very successful lawyer, so I'll assume that you have to employ critical thinking all the time. And because you deal with DUIs, driving under the influence, which is a very specific set of circumstances, and there are tests that determine if somebody was under the influence, there's a lot of critical thinking. There's a lot of elements that you have to look at to try to form a defense, to form questions. How would you define critical thinking?
Oh, gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I guess for me, critical thinking is taking a beat. So anytime you get a piece of information, you have that emotional thinking that happens right away, your emotional response to that information. It's taking a beat and it's going, okay, this is my reaction to this. Where is this reaction coming from? And what does this information actually tell me? And how does it relate to other things? And breaking it down. And I mean, sort of weird to hear myself describe that because it's now like just so inherent in everything I have to do every day. But it is that it's essentially compartmentalizing your emotional reaction to something to an intellectual reaction. And we don't learn a lot in society at all how to compartmentalize. We don't deal with it. They don't teach you that in school. They don't teach you that in university, although they do teach critical thinking in university. And so I think it's something that doesn't come naturally anymore to a lot of people because it's not part of our sort of general education and general upbringing to go, okay, I had a feeling, but I need to separate that from everything else. It's sort of thing you got to go to therapy or law school to do. They're basically the same.
Okay. Helen, what about you? How would you define critical thinking?
Yeah, I think the simplest way to define critical thinking is the act of metacognition, and that's just a technical term to talk about thinking about your own thinking, which obviously touches on the points earlier mentioned, including, you know, thinking through what is your emotion, is your gut feeling actually jading the way you're thinking about things. But ultimately, it's the ability to realize, you know, your own actual cognitive biases and your emotional, your personal experiences that might come and actually cloud your way of thinking. And you know, you're absolutely right. The Reboot Foundation did a study last year in terms of a survey. And while over 97% of the population in the U.S. thought that critical thinking is important, when you get down into the details of, you know, are you practicing critical thinking? How often do you teach your children to think about opposing views? How often do you practice? How often do you actually interact with people, even in person, who have a different point of view? Those statistics obviously decreased dramatically, where over 25% of the people actually said that they will avoid deliberately to even confront people that might have a different opinion than themselves. So, you know, that's the reality today. And the other unfortunate part is what you mentioned about, you know, we don't even know where to teach or learn critical thinking. In the population that we interviewed last year, in the survey that we did, over 23% of the American population actually thought that children should learn themselves critical thinking, for example. So, and whether it's the school's responsibility or the parents' responsibility, it's very confusing. And this is why it's really important to not only start doing it in universities, and I would even argue that even in universities, we don't do a very good job. It needs to be something that needs to be more integrated, starting even in elementary and middle school, the process of actually learning to think about thinking.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking while you were speaking that perhaps the greatest bastion in the mass media right now of critical thinking comes to us via comedy, via comedians, usually late night hosts in their monologues and so on, who manage to boil issues down to their core using humor as a method. And one of the things we've found in North America the past few years, it used to be that stand-up comedians would make their bread and butter on things called nooners, which is they would tour universities and do their act during the lunchtime period. And then not just, you know, lower tier or unknown stand-up comics refused to do it, but big names, bigger names, people like Chris Rock were saying, you know what? I'm not even going in anymore to these universities because all I get is pilloried because comedy is politics by other means. Comedy, when it's not knock-knock jokes or puns, though puns can make you think, the best comedy makes you think. You think of people like George Carlin, you think of Lenny Bruce, you think of Richard Pryor, You think of all these people who during times of
Chris Rock.
And Chris Rock during times of great civil upheaval. It was comedians that helped really define the issues for the average people and do it in a way that people didn't feel attacked. You know, spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So while comedy has been suppressed over the past few years, we've seen a rise on social media of whataboutism, and the, for whatever reason, be it purposeful or ignorant, abandonment of critical thinking, people comparing things which are not in any way or the same or have a very, very, very thin thread of connectivity. But when you look at the context, they have nothing at all in common. Andrew, how do you feel about that? Do you think that comedians play an important role in this kind of thing? Seth Meyers in the United States is one of my favorites. Stephen Colbert, we've got John Oliver. Sure. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I rely on them to keep me up to date on U.S. news because I can't stomach a lot of it. But with that sort of spoonful of sugar and a little bit of comedy, it's great. I want to come back to earlier on, we were talking a lot about that sort of role of the media. And I do want to make the point that there is a lot of good reporting, a lot of good in-depth stuff out there. You know, sort of features, kind of stuff we do at the TIE. The Globe and Mail does a pretty good job, you know, most of the time. Often they have long, long things. But sometimes when we talk about the media, we have this impression that comes from Twitter or Facebook, where it does sort of deliver, as we were talking about earlier, that news that you agree with. Anyway, I do think people can seek out stuff that is, you know, sort of the granola of the media as opposed to the cotton candy of it that we get from social media.
May I interject?
Yes.
Okay, so when I'm talking about the media, I'm exactly talking about mainstream media. Andrew, the TIE is different. I have written for you guys. You guys have great pieces. You guys actually bring in diverse voices. This is not your typical media. This is not typical mainstream media. By the way, thank you.
Yeah, but and what I'm getting at is it is there and people can seek it out.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Totally. Yeah, and I'm not trying to say that it's all media and, you know, whatever. But there is a problem in the Canadian media mainstream, I would say, about not contextualizing these issues, not treating them in a way that does not center, and this is not you because you're not downtown Toronto, but there is sort of like a Toronto-centric view or a Laurentian elite-centric view of media in this country. And I think they failed us.
Well, let me ask you this. Hold on. Let me just jump in here for a second. On the principle of you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. We've been reading about and experiencing shorter attention spans. A lot of people trace it back to the launch of MTV and the fast visuals and everything being fast. And now people are busy. Our lives are busier than ever, perhaps. And the context might be out there. The mainstream media may be providing context, longer articles, columnists providing context, but our attention spans are so short that are people even bothering to read it? Have they just lost interest?
Yes, they are.
Okay, I'm going to push back on you, Stephen, and I'm going to say, and it has been proved through studies, that long-form content outperforms.
It does. Outperform, but who's it being consumed by? Is it being consumed by people who are seeking in-depth information, or is it being consumed by the people that actually need to be reading it?
You mean people need to be informed?
The thing about it is that it, you know, I'm going to requote Stephen now and just say that there are certain outlets that are doing great work. Don't get me wrong. Okay. I've read some great media out there. I think a lot of the great media is not being done by mainstream media.
Definitely not.
Okay.
But it is getting done and you can find it.
Yes, it is.
So true confession time. So during the election, we had these I may have said this on an earlier podcast even, but that we had these narratives around, you know, blackface and Andrew Scheer's resume, Andrew, and stuff. And meanwhile, like I was putting out things like, you know, 2,000 word pieces on the employment insurance system and what needs to be done to fix it, and feeling like I was talking, you know, the pieces had readers, but it sort of felt like the discussion was elsewhere. Anyway, and I was moaning about that to various people, and including Elizabeth May, and she said, "I read it." So to Hafiz's point a bit there, I do think you put stuff out there, and the people who need to find it will find it, and the people who are getting all their news from Twitter and Facebook, I'm not sure how we reach them. And
I would argue
if I can.
I would argue that those are the people that need to read this stuff.
Absolutely.
It's not the people who willingly seek out and eagerly seek out these longer pieces with context that need to. It's the people who don't that need to. And sorry to interrupt, Hafiz, but I want to go to Helen. Helen, what's the danger in societies where we stop treasuring critical thinking as a measure of choosing policy, public discourse, and so on? What are the pitfalls?
Well, I mean, you just have to go down the borders and see what's going on in the U.S., right, frankly. But no, I don't want to give you a aloof answer like that. But I actually do think that what's at danger is democracy. I actually think what's at danger is the question of future workforce, because, you know, one thing we're not talking about that's linked to the dangers of not doing critical thinking is we talk a lot about AI and artificial intelligence and whatnot, but, you know, our current education system is all around fact-based information gathering, in terms of not the thinking part, but just it's all about rote and memorizing facts. Well, the truth of the matter is computers will always do it better than us. And what society needs is actually better thinkers. And yet in our education system, that's not the way most of our schools, public and private, are catering towards the way we measure students, towards the way we think about educating students. And everything is about productivity, efficiency, measurements. And by doing that, it's all based on test-based education, which ultimately means, yes, you measure how much facts these children actually garnered, rather than giving the possibility for teachers to actually create curriculum that helps children to develop their methods of thinking. You know, one of the horrible facts is one third of middle school students in the U.S., so eighth graders, actually admit that they only often learn how to judge reliability of sources and fact-checking. Only 20% think they actually learned it in school. And most of the children actually, a third of the students said that they're rarely or never learning the skill set, and 40% of the students said sometimes they get some information around it. So if we're not actually helping the next generation do this, you know, it's going to only get aggravated and worse than what we're talking about today with our population of who's discerning media.
It's interesting you say that. I've always said, I mean, I'll be honest, I did very well in school because I learned how to play the system. I never did homework. I always said that the most important thing that people learn in school is how to learn. The actual facts of Pythagorean theorem will probably never, ever enter your life. But learning how to learn, learning how to assimilate facts, how to compare facts, how to research facts, the focus is not on that. The focus, as you said, Helen, is on giving back the rote answers, giving back the right answers, as opposed to the process by which you arrived at those answers. In math classes, they always say, show your work. I didn't do very well in that class either. But we don't have that very much when a book report is asked for, or when a project about history or something is tasked to a student. we don't say, show us your work. We say, what's the bibliography, but not, how did you get to these ideas? The idea of how to learn is being completely overlooked by what they learn. Sorry, who wanted to speak there? Was that you,
It was
Erica?
Me, sorry. I'm going to add to what Helen said because I completely agree. We're also taught to learn linearly. We're not taught to think dynamically. We're not taught to make links. We're not taught that everything is connected. And so first of all, let me give you an example. I believe one of the reasons that we have multinational, really powerful companies starts with deregulation in the 80s. You know, mm-hmm. That's a link. We have spent a generation telling kids not to study history, not to study the critical thinking type of subjects that would lead us to understand the world we're in. We have an education system that is for training for jobs, and that's it. That's it. And so you learn, you're right, Stephen, you learn the system. You don't necessarily learn the actual pieces that could lead you towards a more sort of dynamic and less linear thought pattern.
Okay, Kyla, your thoughts on that?
I agree with that. I don't agree with you, Stephen, though. I don't agree that writing a book report or something like that is not going to teach you to show your work and that you're not going to learn how to think critically. And my background before law, I have a bachelor's degree in First Nations studies with a minor in English literature. And I can tell you that a lot of the critical thinking skills that I was taught and that I learned came from English literature and reading a text and thinking critically about the text. What is the author really trying to say and why are they trying to say it? The problem is that kids in school and just generally our society, we don't put much value on that type of work. And kids, when they're asked to give a book report, they're asked to, you know, recite the facts of the book and what happened so that they can prove they read the story, not so that they can prove they understand the meaning of it. It's only when you get to those higher level courses in school that are elective that then you get to develop those skills. And the people who are going to go into those courses are the people who are more inclined to engage in critical thinking.
I would just like to, I just want to talk over you. I just want to clarify, Kyla. I wasn't saying that in English you don't use critical thinking. What I'm saying is that the stress is not on critical thinking, that you teachers don't ask you, show me your work, show me how you arrived at this analysis of the book. They don't, like math does, show me how you got to you know, this figure that you have at the bottom. I don't think that, you know, English is a place where we're not learning critical thinking. I think it absolutely is, and especially it depends on the quality of the teacher. I was simply referring to the fact that there's less emphasis on showing your work, on the process of the critical thinking that helped you arrive at the report that you turned in than there is in math. That's all.
Right. And I agree with that. Because in school, when you're tested, you know, when you go through the process of standardized testing or testing, they have like the foundational skills assessments. I think they're getting rid of those in British Columbia now. But the types of standardized testing, they can't test for your critical thinking skills because there's not a right answer to a question. You can't run it through a Scantron. So they teach, and this happens everywhere, the teaching is to the test. It's to make people conform their thinking to a way that's going to arrive at a right answer. You know, what does bastion mean in this paragraph? Not, you know, why is the author choosing the word bastion and how does that impact the meaning of the text that the author is trying to convey? These are two different questions, but they employ two completely different styles of thinking.
Okay.
Go ahead, Helen.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So I know I took us to critical thinking and responsibility of schools and teachers, but actually The Reboot Foundation, we believe that teaching critical thinking is largely even more the responsibility of parents. And I think it goes back, we do a full circle in terms of the beginning part of this conversation about instant gratification, going after getting the latest fact news and having it emotional. I mean, clearly children will learn by how parents set an example, but how often do we now, you know, sit in front of our iPhones at the dinner table rather than actually having a discussion or a debate? Maybe not with all the facts as a lawyer would have, but it's spending that time with the children and actually allowing slow thinking, staying and moving away from instant gratification that I think is part of the start of actually the basis of critical thinking. And it really starts at the home as well. And so that's where it's a little bit scary is if this, you know, adult generation, you know, we consider ourselves doing less and less critical thinking. What does that actually, you know, forebode for the next generation? And that's why we really all collectively really need to make an effort as parents as well.
Okay, let me ask you then, continuing on what you were saying, Helen, and I'm going to ask each panelist this as well as we begin to close, because it is 6 hours later in Paris for Helen, and we have to have some mercy on the woman to get some sleep. What do you think the path is realistically towards increasing public's interest in critical thinking, in promoting critical thinking and the value of critical thinking? Can we do this by using the same techniques that the people who discourage critical thinking use?
Well, I think, I'm assuming that you're, you know, implying what governments are, you know, want to do. I actually think that the public interest is there to improve critical thinking. It's, you know, I don't think it's less today than it was, call it, in the 70s, because you could argue it was propaganda, much more critical thinking than it is today. I think it is actually, I do believe that ultimately, there's two ways that public interest need to think about it. We do need to think about how do we better collaborate and put in methods with social media, for-profit medium that's actually giving us information to better manage so that there are tools, for example, to trigger, you know, putting perimeters around emotion-based or, you know, things that are going on even in the U.S. today in terms of pure, obvious fake news, somewhat monitoring some elements of that to try to hone that in. And then the second is what governments and the public education will do more towards critical thinking within the schools and actually helping students and teachers, but also, you know, the actual toolkit and the medium so that we have we're fully equipped for critical thinking. You know, I don't want to do a self-promotion, but, you know, the Reboot Foundation, actually, we came out this summer with the Parental Guide for Critical Thinking with exact concrete examples and case studies and actually the pedagogy around based on neuroscientists and cognitive scientists that show what is age appropriate to learn critical thinking, because obviously a child who's 7 years old, his brain is not yet developed enough as a 14-year-old to be able to do all of the logical thinking, for example, or abstracting thinking. So this is the type of tool and guides that we're hoping, and, you know, we are trying to do in the small means to promote the word around it, but we are getting a lot of interest from different governments as well as nonprofit groups and schools to learn more about these tools.
Okay, Hafiz,
do
you think?
So I'm optimistic.
I'm glad. It's good to have optimists still in this world. Hafiz, quickly, your thoughts. How do we promote to the general public the importance of critical thinking?
Well, look, the way you communicate to people today is through the spectrum of social media that we have. If critical thinking is a value that we want people to possess, then we need to produce content that will translate into people actually coming in, looking at that, and changing their way of thinking. You know, we have woke culture You might as well make critical thinking woke and put that content out there. Put it through a spin of making it interesting and bring it out to the everyday people. I mean, you saw a little bit of this start to take place over the last few years where people were starting to use logical fallacies from critical thinking classes to undermine bad arguments on social media. But the people that were doing that didn't understand those logical fallacies either. So it's an interesting situation. I think for me, myself, I actually took a critical thinking course in Cap College way back in the day. And it's an interesting journey that anyone can go under in going in and actually learning how to dissect an argument and to validate it. And I think it's an important skill. The only way that we're actually going to get people to get into it, though, is if we can somehow find a way to turn it into amusing content.
Sadly. Okay, Kyla?
I'm to some extent in agreement with Hafiz in the sense that, you know, the way that we're getting the vast majority of our information these days is from social media, but I don't think we should make it something where people can just voluntarily access it through social media. We need to put pressure on companies that are developing social media platforms to trick people into learning how to think critically, because nobody's going to reach out and do it themselves if they're resistant to it already.
How would that happen? Wait, hang on. How would that? I like this idea, but by which means do you trick people into critical thinking?
Well, get rid of the availability, the easy availability of silencing the differing views and putting yourself into the echo chamber. I mean, you have right now on Twitter, for example, you can press the mute button if you don't like somebody and they don't know that you hit it, and you can press the block button. And I see all the time accounts that have blocked me, the people who I've never met in my life, that I've never had any interaction with on social media or otherwise. And I can only conclude that the reason that they're doing that is that they don't agree with some type of view that I've expressed on social media. But I think they should put more restrictions on the, first of all, on the way that these algorithms are used to create these echo chambers so that people are exposed to more ideas and have to think critically, but also more restrictions on how much you can silence other people to cater your experience to only reinforce your own views. And that would be easy for them to do by tweaking the algorithm.
Okay, you agree, Hafiz?
I do agree to a point. I don't think the social media companies want critical thinkers, though. Imagine the content on Instagram if people actually thought critically.
Well, there's some places critical thinking doesn't need to be. There's some places you can get a vacation from critical thinking, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. The problem is when you take an extended sabbatical from critical thinking. Andrew, your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely some forums lend themselves better to critical thinking than others. In general, I agree with the point that it takes lifelong practice to develop critical thinking. We were talking about the school system earlier and English classes, and I agree that preparing for a multiple choice test or a standardized test doesn't, in most cases, develop critical thinking, but an essay does. Like in an essay, you have to show what say what you think, show why you think it, defend your ideas. It's a great place to learn critical thinking.
But how do we convince people that it's important? How do we convince the next generation and the generations that are out there now that critical thinking is so important to democracy, as Helen said?
I think people don't necessarily need to be convinced that they just, we need to raise generations that sort of live inside of it in a way where we read to kids when they're little and we read them things that are varied and that present, different worldviews and that sort of thing. So that by the time they get to school, they have some ideas and they can defend them in an essay. And then later, for people like me who are producing things for people to read, hopefully we produce things that are argued in a way that people can engage with. For us, we have a comment section after every story and often the discussion in there is actually pretty good.
Really? Well, that's a rarity. Usually those are garbage fires.
They usually are. There was actually an academic study of different comment sections on I think they looked at three different outlets, and ours actually came out as like being fairly reasonable. Like there was a lot of the sort of "you're an idiot" type comment, but often it was like "you're an idiot," and here's why I think that. So you know, it was not
at least
all
it's
bad.
Something. Yeah, usually yeah. Usually when it's just "you're an idiot," the "you're" is a "you" and an "r." Erica, your thoughts? How do we impress upon people the importance of critical thinking and maybe make them recognize that they're not employing it enough? Oh, Erica's not there.
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Is it my turn?
Yes. Okay. So, how do we, I'll just repeat the question. How do we impress upon people the importance of critical thinking, which means confronting and reading ideas that you don't initially agree with and you may not agree with at the end, but why it's important to you know, challenge yourself to think, why it's important to democracy? How do we convince people that it's more important to read articles written by people you don't agree with than by people who you agree with completely?
Well, I want to push back on this "people you don't agree with," because that's how we platform white supremacists, okay? Because the argument is, oh, you're just listening to somebody who you don't agree with. But to me, as a person of color in this country, I don't feel that I have to listen to somebody who is attacking my quote unquote true Canadianness.
No. Of course, you know, and of course not. I was not suggesting in the least that if you're reading a responsible journalist, go find an irresponsible one. That's Fox News's idea of fair and balanced.
Right.
That's not, so which isn't balanced.
I usually will parse out a piece. I usually don't just say, this is trash. I will say, this is terrible because X, Y, Z. And there are points in there. And I find that Twitter social media, honestly, can actually produce some critical thinking. Some of the best critical thinking I've read is in Twitter essays, but it all depends on who you follow. And it goes back to the echo chamber, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to algorithms, I think algorithms are the devil, because they are serving us content that they think we want to see, not necessarily content that is true. And given Facebook's position on not fact-checking political ads, that's a huge issue, and it is a huge issue for democracy.
I agree.
And to be honest, we don't have the personnel in positions of power who understand these platforms enough to actually push back and ask the right questions. And that to me is a huge issue.
I like going back to Carla's idea of using algorithms to trick people.
I like that idea too.
Yeah, I like that. This book, you might like this book, and it's something that's completely different.
It's completely different.
Yeah.
I like
that idea of tricking them. I mean, it's much... It's much better than my idea, because my idea was to do like they did in the 80s, the anti-drug campaign, and make a really cool rap video.
Yeah, but we see how that worked out.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, of course. All right. I want to thank all of you.
Wait, Steven,
yes, yes.
Just let me say this piece.
Yes.
The reason, you know where I learned to ask questions was that in the home. I learned from my parents how to challenge presumptions. It was not just through school. It was that I had another sort of layer of questioning happening because I went home and we talked over the dinner table and we talked about politics. I've been talking about politics since I was 10 years old because my parents made sure that I needed to know what was going on in my country. And I really do think parents need to take, if the school isn't doing it, parents need to do it. And what I see is a lot of parents not being critical thinkers and producing children who are less so because of, again, the algorithm. So there is a baseline. They haven't provided their children a baseline. And therefore, when they go into school and they go into, like, critical thinking I agree, happens in places like English literature. Like Lord of the Flies, I remember my English literature teacher challenging us on Lord of the Flies and challenging us on the idea of society. And that to me was my favorite class. And
interesting.
I think we need as a society to start not just questioning, but challenging presumptions. Because there are a lot of arguments made on presumptions that are that just don't hold anymore. Or
I think
may
we
not.
Need to. I think we need to make being uncomfortable the new comfortable.
Well, I that's my work, Stephen.
Oh well, you keep
that
at
is
it.
My work.
You did an excellent job in your article in Maclean's, and you're also the host of the Bad and Bitchy podcast, which I encourage people to take a listen to. Your comments, Erica, back up what Helen was saying about the importance of parents and the home. Helen Lee Buig is the founder of the Reboot Foundation, talking to us from Paris. And Helen, being an American originally, who's now in Paris, you may not know this, but Reboot is actually the name of a very popular Canadian cartoon from the 1990s.
I did not know that.
Yeah, look it up. Reboot. It's any kid who grew up in the 90s, maybe the 80s, 90s, they know when they think about Reboot, they think about these cartoon characters. So, but thank you for staying up so late in Paris. And where can people find the Reboot Foundation?
So you can go on reboot-foundation.org and you will find the guide for parents that I mentioned, the surveys that we've done. And I'm looking for those folks on this panel to help me promote this, you know, elevation of critical thinking, especially for parents, via your resources. And I really appreciate it for inviting me on this talk.
Well, I appreciate the work you're doing because it's important and more people need to do it. Hafiz Narani, you're a digital marketing consultant and analyst, and you're the producer of Mensplaining, the podcast here on FU Politics. And this week's episode is actually tied into where we started this podcast tonight. We're going to be looking at jock culture.
Yep.
And so people should don't be fooled by the name Mensplaining. If you think it's a bunch of guys whining about loss of power, it absolutely isn't that at all. Thank you for joining us, Hafiz. Kyla Lee, out in BC, you won my heart by saying we should trick people. For their own good. But you are a leading DUI lawyer out on the West Coast, and thank you very much for joining us. And Andrew McLeod, an award-winning author and the legislative bureau chief for the West Coast's premier political website, The Tie. Andrew, you've been with us before. I hope you'll be with us again.
Yeah, thanks. Anytime.
Okay. And thanks to all of you, and thanks to everybody who's listening. And if you've felt enriched in any way by this dialogue, help enrich us, because we're up against pretty powerful media machines in what we're trying to do with Fund the FU Network, which is civil dialogue that has some sense of humor amongst people who may not always agree, but still see each other as valuable human beings. In other words, people don't set themselves on fire and scream at each other. We need support for that. So if you're so inclined to become a patron, go to patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. Or if you want to do a one-time boost, it's PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. So thank you to everybody, all of our panelists. Thank you for listening. Hopefully this is giving you a chance to think about things and encouraged you to maybe challenge some of your preconceived notions. I'm Stephen Kersner on the No Bullpen on FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network. That's quite a mouthful. We've got to shorten that one up. Thank you very much, everybody.
This is Fun, the FU Network.